Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids. Some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I just, for me, I always, on television, watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton?
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 Weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.
Ready for some football? Specifically some Green Bay Packers football? Well, you're not alone. Training camp started this week, and Packers Plus editor Rick Clower talked to our new Packers beat writer, Michael Cohen, about how the team looks. We'll have that and more in today's Behind the Headlines podcast. As usual, I'm your host, Katie O'Connell. Thanks for joining me. In our first segment, when a doctor writes a prescription, there's a certain amount of trust. For instance, you trust that the medication will help you. But as medical reporter John Faber found out, that's not necessarily the case. John talked to reporter Marion Renault about the latest in his risk-reward investigative series. The series examines the trade-offs people may inadvertently make by taking newer drugs, such as newer diet drugs or newer cancer treatments. Here's John talking about a drug that's used for a treatment in an irregular heartbeat and the consequences of that drug.
These drugs are all designed to prevent strokes in people who have a certain type of irregular heartbeat. It's known as atrial fibrillation, AFib, and in people with that disease, the blood can collect in the upper chambers of the heart. And when the blood sort of sits there, clots can form, and those clots can be sent to the brain and cause a stroke. So all these drugs, the newer ones and warfarin, are designed to prevent strokes in people who have AFib. For decades, really, the only drug that was available to treat clot is a drug called warfarin. That's been around since 1954, and in the last 5 years, 4 new drugs have come on the market that are designed to be alternatives to warfarin. And these drugs are more convenient to use than warfarin because they don't require the regular testing that warfarin requires. They're also much more expensive, a lot more expensive, and they have some individual issues. The big one is that with all of the newer drugs, and there's 4 of them, there is not an antidote that can be given in the event there's a serious bleeding issue like a head injury or a bad ulcer. With warfarin, you can give people, actually give them vitamin K, and that will start to bring clotting back to where normal levels. With these new drugs, they don't have an antidote, so there's a concern that if there is a serious bleeding emergency, that some people may actually die because they aren't able to stop the bleeding.
What was your entryway into this story?
Well, you know, I've been a medical reporter for a number of years, so I'd been seeing a lot of news about them over the years. The first one came on the market in 2010. Over the last year or so, I'd been doing a series of stories looking at new drugs that were approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. We first did some stories about cancer drugs, and then we did some stories about diabetes drugs, and then we did some stories about diet drugs, and this was sort of next on our list.
And what did you find?
I guess one of the things we found that's concerning is that in the last 4 or 5 years since these drugs first came on the market, somewhere around 7,500 people have died who were taking these drugs. Most of these are bleeding-related deaths. These new drugs accounted for about 90% of the deaths, but only about 15% of the prescriptions. And so there's a concern that, you know, that there may be an imbalance in the number of deaths and serious events that can occur, like hospitalizations or major bleeding incidents.
Do doctors know that there is this increased risk? Or why would a doctor prescribe, you know, one of these new drugs?
Well, the main reason is they're much more convenient. Warfarin is kind of a pain in the butt, really. You have to get testing once a month, maybe. And that's, you know, a big inconvenience. That's the real big reason these drugs are becoming more popular. Their prescriptions for them are growing quite a bit and probably will continue to grow for a while. Number of people who are now candidates for using an anticoagulant who weren't before, it's about 1 million people. So under the old system, about 3.7 million Americans were candidates for getting these drugs. That number went up to 4.7 million. The cost of taking warfarin and having the testing done for a year is going to be, you know, well under $1,000, whereas the cost of being on one of these drugs for a year is going to be well over $4,000.
And were you able to talk to any patients for this story?
I talked to just the family of one patient. She was 88 years old, and she had atrial fibrillation. At the end of 2011, at age 88, her doctor decided to put her on one of the newer drugs. And a couple of months later, she had developed a serious bleeding as a result of an ulcer. They took her to the hospital and tried to stop the bleeding and couldn't. And after being in the hospital for a couple of days, she died.
For readers who aren't affected by AFib or might not know anyone with it, is this story any part of a greater theme in pharmaceutical news right now? Are there other newer forms of treatment that might carry a risk that hasn't been yet?
Well, we have been looking at new drug approvals. We found that 74% of the new cancer drugs that have come on the market in the last decade were approved based on what they call surrogate measures of benefit, meaning that they make a lab test look better or they make a CT scan look better, but they aren't actually proven to prove the quality of your life. And then we did a follow-up story looking at all the new diabetes drugs that have come on the market, and there have been about 30 in the last decade. And once again, all of those drugs were being approved based on a surrogate measure. They improved a test known as hemoglobin A1C, which is a sort of a measure of how much sugar is in your blood. But none of them were proven to actually reduce the kinds of things that are really important if you have diabetes, type 2 diabetes, which is heart attacks, strokes, blindness, amputations. So then we did a story on the new diet drugs. And diet drugs had a really checkered history. They were known to cause all kinds of serious problems. In fact, when the FDA approved the first one a few years ago, they had not approved any in 13 years, and they had rejected several of them because of concerns about their safety. But all of this is part of a bigger look at just the idea of risk and benefit that comes with various medical therapies.
If you want to find John's Risk Reward series, it's available at jsonline.com/watchdog. There's a wealth of information there. On this story alone, you'll find a timeline of warfarin's history, a graphic about the risks and the benefits of the drug, plus a ton of more information. You can also find the bulk of this information in Sunday's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And in lighter news... it's almost time for the Wisconsin State Fair. Here's Marianne with more.
Allison Garcia and Kathy Flanagan are more than reporters extraordinaire. They are Wisconsin State Fair pros. Kathy's been there 50 times, and Allison has done the ejection seat and lived to tell the tale. They've got the update on what's new to the late summer state attraction, which, by the way, opens August 6th and runs through the 16th. When do they start setting up for it?
They have been. I mean, you'll drive by and you'll see
really? The
midway starting to begin. It should be this weekend. It really should. It takes them a while.
Now, I'm from Minneapolis, and I've only ever been to the Minnesota State Fair once, so I had to ask them to give their best stab at converting me into a Wisconsin fairgoer. In as few words as possible, try to convince me to go to the State Fair for the first time.
Food.
I'll see your food and I'll raise you. 16 new Wisconsin beers at the micro. Well, they're not new beers, but 16 beers at the micro. You can also try a flight of beers. And some people swear by the beer mosa. I don't know.
That's cheating. That was more than one word.
I know. Beer. Beer. Your food. Raise your beer.
What are you two most looking forward to there this year?
If you can handle the suspense, I would say that Nick Walenda is something worth seeing. He's going to be attempting his longest walk to date. So he's the guy who... did the wire walk between the two Chicago skyscrapers and also like Niagara Falls, the Grand Canyon. So it'll be cool to have them in Wisconsin above the Milwaukee Mile racetrack. It would be something worth watching, but it might make my heart pound a little too much.
He's going to get us as much attention as the lion.
What other new things are going to be at the state fair this year?
The Sea Lion Splash will be there, and that's a traveling pack of sea lions who come and they do tricks, they bounce balls, shoot hoops. So they'll be there, which will be kind of neat. And there will also be plein air, which is a French thing, meaning open air. They're going to have artists run around the fair and paint fair-inspired work, and then there's a little competition for the winner, and then people can buy some of the works.
How about in terms of food and beer?
Well, this year they have 101 new food items, and they try not to eat themselves every year. So once again, bacon is the really, I think there are 18 items with bacon in them. I can't imagine who would try all these. But then the other side of this is there's some actually semi-healthy sounding foods there. So if you don't really want a beer battered, pretzel coated in deep fried cheese curd, then you could also get a chicken Milano, a Greek wine chicken with garlic vegetables served in a pita with a salad. So, there's some diversity of taste and healthfulness.
What is the weirdest thing that's going to be new this year?
Well, there are 101 of them. The bacon bottom porker pizza. They did this at Summerfest too. There's no crust. It's a bacon bottom for the pizza. So that just sounds delicious if you love bacon or you want a heart attack. No, it's actually, it sounds pretty good. And I think it's getting a lot of attention. I think the other thing that sounds pretty good is deep fried pretzel crusted brownies on a stick.
Yeah. How much of it is on a stick this year?
Not as many as usual. I mean, I think they've actually upturned the stick item and gone for bacon, but you'll still find some things on a stick. And you can't go to the Wisconsin State Fair without getting a cream puff. That's sort of the hallmark.
What do you guys eat every year?
I always go back for an apple turnover, where they sell the baked potatoes, which there's always a line for. They have all things apple, and their apple turnovers are really pretty good. So I always get one of those, and I'll buy anything from the 4-H kids.
So whether you've been to the state fair or not, and hopefully Marianne goes, you'll want to pick up this Sunday's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Kathy and Allison, as well as music writer Piet Levy, are covering everything fair-related. They've got all sorts of tips there, including how to get into the fair at a discounted rate. That information is also available online at tapmilwaukee.com. Would you buy an $80 shirt? A new store in the Third Ward thinks you would. Agnel Philip got the scoop on this new store from business reporter Rick Rommel.
This is Agnel Philip, business reporting intern at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I'm here with Rick Rommel, another business reporter at the Journal Sentinel, and we're here today to talk about his Kit and Ace story. Kit and Ace is a new clothing store that's opening up in the Third Ward. It actually opened this past Thursday, and it sells $80 t-shirts aimed at young professionals and has the clothing success gene in its DNA. So, Rick, could you first start off by telling me a little bit about the story and walk me through what exactly Kit and Ace is?
When you said clothing success gene and its DNA, exactly right. Because the owners, the founders of Kit and Ace are a Vancouver man and woman by the name of Shannon Wilson and her stepson, JJ Wilson. And they are the wife and son, respectively, of Dennis Chip Wilson, who founded the Lululemon Athletica company and has made just a boatload of money selling $100 yoga pants and other performance-type clothing over the last 20 years or so. And Kit and Ace, it's a small operation. It's a 1,200, 1,300 square foot store, but it's interesting because of the products they're selling and the sort of heritage of the founders.
And what are those products that they're selling, and who are they trying to get with it? Because $80 t-shirts are really expensive. So what's the play here?
Well, they definitely are targeting the young professional people with money who have a certain, I don't know, kind of urban style, I guess. They've come up with a fabric that they call technical cashmere. They're selling it as though it has the sort of the luxury, the soft feel of cashmere, but doesn't have the high maintenance aspects of real cashmere. And the amount of actual cashmere in technical cashmere is really quite small, less than 10% from what I gather in looking at their descriptions on their website. The rest is other fibers, other fabrics that have been blended in. But the advantage is you can throw it in a washing machine. Supposedly it doesn't pill up, it doesn't stretch out, bag, that kind of thing.
And how does this fit within the existing businesses on the Third Ward? There's no shortage of high-end clothing in that area. So how does this fit in within that general area?
Right. I think it's the Third Ward is developing more and more as an upscale retail site. It's been trending that way for some time, but the opening of Kitten Ace, the opening recently of West Elm, which is a home furnishing store right in the corner of Water and St. Paul, has solidified that. Last year, the year before, I think it was 2 years ago, Pendleton, the venerable wool clothing maker, but very pricey blankets and sweaters and that sort of thing, they opened a shop on Broadway. So Kitten Ace is putting a further stamp of kind of upscale retail district on the Third Ward.
Rick also said that Kitten Ace is trying a similar tactic as Lululemon. Both stores were created with a vision of their clients. For Kitten Ace, it's young professionals who are successful in their careers, their social circles, and are in, peak physical health. It's sort of a Field of Dreams mentality. If you build a store for a certain demographic, they'll come and they'll spend. So far, the company has found great success with this technique. Rick has more on this store at jsonline.com/business. It may not seem like political news, but Governor Scott Walker ordering up cheesesteak in Philadelphia certainly was. It was another stop on his presidential campaign. How's that campaign faring overall, especially when compared to media antics of candidate Donald Trump? Reporter Craig Gilbert joined Greg Borowski on this week's JS on Politics show to gauge Walker's time on the road.
We're joined now by Craig Gilbert, our Washington bureau chief, to talk a little bit about how Scott Walker is faring in various polls. So, Craig, let's start with the national picture, where Scott Walker is in the top three. Importantly, bunched up at the top is Donald Trump at 19.2%, Jeb Bush at 13.4%, and Scott Walker at 12.6%. And I should say this is a compilation of polls on the Real Clear Politics site. So, Craig, what's your take on how he's situated himself nationally? He's certainly among the leading contenders.
Yeah, if you look at the last 7 or 8 months, when he came out of the gate and after that speech in Iowa and kind of rocketed to the front of the field, he became, by anybody's measure, part of that frontier of Republican candidates nationally. His numbers kind of subsided after that as other candidates got in the race and got some attention, and he was kind of falling back into the crowd. Then with his announcement, I think he got a little bit of a bump, despite the fact that Donald Trump was kind of crowding a lot of people out and overshadowing the field. So that's why you see Trump up there with his very high name ID and all the media attention he's getting. But Scott Walker, I think, is in a pretty good place. I mean, he's up there with Jeb Bush, ahead of this very large and kind of undifferentiated pack of Republicans behind him.
All right, now let's look at Iowa, because at this stage it's not one national race, it's 50 individual races. And in Iowa, Scott Walker's faring extremely well. He still remains at the top of the pack with 19.3%, followed by Donald Trump, who they had their little back and forth on over the weekend, and then Jeb Bush after that. So, Craig, what is your take on how the governor's faring in Iowa?
He's been the front runner in Iowa for a long time now, which is, again, a good place for him to be. There is a riskiness attached to this because The expectations will be very high for him in Iowa. That's why he's spending a lot of time there. He can't afford to have a disappointing showing, especially when everybody's expecting him at this point to either win or place in Iowa. But very consistent numbers, very consistently the front runner in Iowa.
Let's just talk very briefly, looking ahead to next Thursday when the first Republican debate is, this sort of cast of thousands, and I think they have two debates just to squeeze them all in. But is this a opportunity for Skywalker to gain support, or is he more on the just doesn't want to, you know, make any big mistakes that would cost him support at this stage?
Yeah, I mean, there's an element of both. I mean, one thing that, one signal that Scott Walker has sent pretty clearly, I mean, I talked to him about this earlier this week in Philadelphia on a campaign stop, is he really doesn't want to engage with his fellow Republican candidates, certainly doesn't want to skirmish with them. He says that he views these debates as sort of a conversation directly with viewers. And so there will be some candidates who will be going on the attack, whether it's the attack against Scott Walker or the attack against Donald Trump. Scott Walker doesn't really want to be part of that. I think it serves him well. One of the reasons it serves him well is that he is somebody who's trying to attract Republican support across the spectrum. So he really doesn't want to alienate any particular group of Republicans, and it kind of fits his personal style.
All right, we'll have much more on the debate next week, but thank you for that update on the polls, Craig.
Walker is also meeting with some big political donors in California this weekend. You can find that segment and more at jsonline.com/politics. You can also download the full JS on Politics show as a podcast from iTunes or Stitcher Radio. The first day of Packers training camp gives us fans a glimpse at how our players held up during the offseason. Journal Sentinel reporter Michael Cohen was there on day one. Packers Plus editor Rick Clower got his take on the day and his predictions moving forward.
Michael, today was the first day of Packers training camp. What were your impressions early on of the first day?
Yeah, it seemed like it was a pretty good run overall for everybody. Obviously, a beautiful weather day up here in Green Bay, so there were no issues there. And everyone seemed generally very excited, as you would expect from the first day of camp. And I just think the fact that the veteran presences on this team, there's so many of them, they really can help along this training camp process. When you have 11 guys returning as your offensive starters, you know, it just means that you're that much more ahead, you know, at the start. And on defense, they have, you know, a slew of starters coming back as well. So it seemed like a very businesslike first practice. You know, the guys know what to expect. And as Jordy Nelson said, there isn't a lot of need to be going through and teaching, you know, the basic plays because there are so many people that have been here before. So I think the team is in a good spot. They're excited about the roster that they have. And, you know, overall, it looked like a very good practice.
Was there any major surprises or anybody that really stood out?
You know, with some of the injuries into the secondary, which I'll detail in a second, Ladarius Gunter, a rookie cornerback out of Miami, who was acquired via free agency, played and got a lot of opportunities, and he made a really big interception, the first interception of 11-on-11 play. Aaron Rodgers lofted a pass down the left sideline toward Jared Aberderis, and it was picked off by Gunter, who ended up making a beautiful catch and a beautiful play on the ball to sort of take it out of the hands of Aberderis. And on that play, Aberderis kind of went down and fell awkwardly, and he got a ride back to the facility and did not return to practice. Head coach Mike McCarthy said he didn't think, based on the way Aberderis fell, that it had anything to do with the knee injury that Aberderis suffered last season, and he thought it might be a tailbone issue or something like that. And then there was another part of practice where Sam Shields, the veteran quarterback, sort of tweaked something in his foot. You know, a lot of the media members thought it might have been an ankle, but McCarthy downplayed it after practice and said it was actually just Sam Shields having some issues with his shoes. So Shields was in and out of practice twice. He left, came back, left, came back, got his shoes taped. And that offered some more reps for Gunter as a quarterback. So he looked good today in that corner position. And I would say he was the most pleasant surprise of the afternoon.
Who else sat out to practice?
Well, the only real big absence that, you know, we weren't necessarily anticipating due to injury was Andrew Corliss, the tight end, wasn't there. And McCarthy said that, you know, he's sort of gone indefinitely to take care of a very difficult family situation, but he did not go into any details beyond that. So that's something we'll have to keep an eye on. And then the only other guys that sat out were the guys that were reported as being on the PUP list or the non-football injury list. And there's an update there about Quentin Rollins, the second round pick, defensive back who's likely going to challenge for a starting spot. He was the player on the non-football injury list, which means his injury was suffered away from a team activity. Rollins was around in the locker room and basically said that he was just conditioning on his own a couple weeks ago back at Miami of Ohio, where he went to school, and he pulled his right hamstring. He said he feels good. He feels like, you know, he's getting there, and he's just waiting for the medical staff to clear him before he returns to practice. So no real surprises in terms of people that sat out other than Corliss, and there's no timetable for his return, according to McCarthy.
And did Jordy Nelson talk about his hip at all?
Yeah, Jordy was back. He talked about his hip. He was a full participant today. He offered some details about the surgery that were pretty interesting. Basically, Jordy said that there was a genetic issue that caused an impingement in his hip where two things inside of his hip, whether it was a bone and a tendon or a tendon and another part of his hip, he didn't specify. He said there's two things in there that were just rubbing together for years and years and years. And basically, after a couple decades of athletic activity, he just needed to get it cleaned out. So he got everything taken care of, and it's back to normal. He was a full participant. He looked good. And Mike McCarthy said it looked like Jordy didn't miss a beat. So it seems that for any Packer fans who were concerned about Jordy, there's nothing really to worry about there. He looked good today.
All right, Michael, thanks a lot for your insights. You can find more of Michael's stories and blog items at jsonline.com/Packer.
And that wraps up today's show. Thanks again for listening. It's always great to take you behind the headlines in our newsroom. Stay tuned for next week's show.
Stop the podcast!
Stop the podcast!
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids. Some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
Yeah, I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I always on television watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton.
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 Weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.